A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You look, hey.
Dude, I look like Marc Maron.
So it's honestly, it's way less. After you told me what you were doing, I was really expecting...
Wild Man of Borneo?
No, I was expecting, like I told you, I was expecting season 6 Breaking Bad Walter White. That's what I was expecting. Because that's when he goes to Vermont and, you know, I actually just interviewed Alan Sepinwall for Tune Up Podcast, who he's the TV writer for Rolling Stone. And wrote like the book about the Sopranos. Very cool dude. And we got him on. And one of my major questions was kind of like trying to reconcile what the hell happened in like the last 2 episodes of Breaking Bad. Some stuff that's really bothered me.
So I haven't seen all of Breaking Bad.
Okay. I mean, I don't mind spoiling it since it's like, you know, ended like a decade ago. But so you'll catch up. But I mean, at one point, he's basically like the most wanted man in America, and he kind of like drives just an old shitty car from New Mexico to Vermont with like no problems right. whatsoever, which, and then they don't say any part of the trip, nothing. He just like arrives there. I'm like, oh, that seems strange. And then I really have a problem with like the last scene of Breaking Bad. So if you haven't seen it, basically, you know, Walter White, as he goes on, turns into one of the most like notorious criminals in the U.S., Mexico, too. And then he blows up Mexican drug lords.
Oh,
you know,
shit.
he's like crazy.
OK.
And in the last scene, he literally drives into like a neo-Nazi compound who are his enemies. And they don't check his trunk when he drives in. And in the trunk, he has some like insane automatic weapon connected to a, you know, a circular pivoting system on a remote control where he kills like 14 Nazis just by like pressing a button and ducking on the ground. And it's always bothered me. I'm like, listen, I know like rule of thumb, Nazis are dumb, but they're career criminals. And this guy is like one of the most dangerous men in America. And you didn't check his trunk. You just gave him like a little pat down on his way in. I'm like, this is such a brilliant show that like this seems like an oversight. It never made sense to me, you know? And what was funny, he gave me some good insight though on this. Sepinwall, he told me that it was in the spirit of Breaking Bad to basically write things in before they knew what they were going to do with it. So apparently they ended season 5 by showing this giant gun in the trunk. And they're like, fuck, we got to come up with some story about why there's a giant gun in the trunk. So that's why they had to reconcile it like that. And it didn't make any sense. But all this being said, you don't look nearly as much like Walter White as I thought. You look more like a member of Wilco or something. It's very disappointing.
Well, thank you.
You look like fucking alt rocker.
Like Jesus. I said, I didn't really, you know, end it all that, wasn't all that rough, the ending there.
Yeah, it was pretty luxurious,
huh? Pretty nice.
Yeah, I guess it could just as easily go the way of Vineyard Vines. You know, you could have came back some like straight up white boy golfing and yachting clothes too. Some boat shoes, some little pastel Vineyard Vine shorts.
Yeah.
It's kind of turned into like my least favorite person a little bit.
Not really my style.
I see the guy, like if I see, say, a visor.
Ugh.
Some Vineyard Vines, particularly those little like pastel shorts and like a White Claw.
Ugh.
I'm just going to go ahead and like make a 95% ruling that we're just not going to get on, you know?
Yeah. Professional white person.
but more than that, it's like professional white person on vacation.
Oh, right, right.
Or just rich enough to not work anymore. Right. So either of the two, I could, meh.
It's not our tribe, Benny. It's okay.
That's true. So what was your highlight? What was your highlight of being out in the woods?
I gotta say, so probably my buddy's place that was kind of in the middle of the trip, you know, he lucked out and got this place right before COVID and intended to move up there, you know, probably this summer after like kind of getting it fixed up. But they closed on it and stayed. And I know they don't have a lot of money, you know, he and his wife, they're not rolling in it, but
right.
I know they weren't dirt poor either. Sure. But, when he told me he had 25 acres, I was like, whoa, that's like pretty respectable. And then he's been posting on Instagram and the place looks good, but I'm like, you know, you can take a good picture, but dude, he fucking lucked out. My God.
Yeah.
He's got this creek that goes right past his house. It's like, he's got another creek on the other side. Like
two creeks.
It's basically a creek running on either side of his house.
That's like a moat, basically.
It's gorgeous. And it's a real fixer-upper. Don't get me wrong. He's got his work cut out for him. The place is, it basically sat kind of deserted for 20 years.
Gotcha.
But it's a log cabin.
Wow.
But it looks like a spa. Like it's really nice. Got a huge kind of enclosed porch. The build is log cabin. The whole thing is wood. Like there's sheetrock in the whole build.
Very, very
so
cool.
That was impressive because like I was really impressed by what a good fucking deal he got. And it was and it really feels obviously like you're in Vermont, like or you're just in the wilderness. But you know, you can still go take a shower. Can watch TV if you want, you know, it's like, he's still connected, but,
sure.
It's pretty remote. And Northern Vermont is like, Northern Vermont does have its smatterings of Trump signs. They're big libertarians. Sure. They like their guns,
right.
But they also like have kept strip malls out of the entire, pretty much the entire state and chains, you know, it doesn't matter if you're blue or red up there. They're very proud of their local economy. They're farmers, you know,
can't hate on that.
Even the rednecks are, you know, eating the friggin' eggs from up the road.
Right. Sure.
So, like,
yeah, there's a different kind of consciousness up there for sure.
And it's so damn beautiful. I mean, in the summertime, in the winter, it's a fucking glacier.
I think I just said it like I know, and then come to think of it, I don't know if I've ever been north of like Burlington. So,
this was north of Burlington, but Burlington is pretty fucking far north, dude.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So Burlington, that does mean I've driven through most of Vermont then.
Yeah. Burlington is right up there.
You bringing a maple syrup back?
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Some curds? Maybe some cheese curds?
No, but it did have some poutine.
Oh, hell yeah.
You ever had that from Canada?
Oh, yes, I've had that.
Canadian
it's like
poutine.
One of my favorite things. I can't eat it very often because it's often the gravy is not vegetarian.
Right, right.
But there are a lot of spots throughout. There's a really great spot in Montreal that makes vegetarian poutine spots. And then there's a great German style sausage place in my neighborhood that does vegetarian poutine. That's so
fucking really?
Good. Yeah, I get it all the time. It's like my fat boy food when I give myself like a night off from trying to, you know, take care of myself at all.
I've never had it outside of Canada. This was the first time, but we were like 10 miles from the border, so I guess that was good enough.
Fucking love me a curd, man. Speaking of curds, Tim Mickelrath.
Is he Kurdish?
Old country curd out there.
Is that what that name is? That's a Kurdish name?
I mean, when I think of, like, it's, I mean, it's funny. Like, I was even fucking with him before the interview. You know, I ask people before they go in, I'm like, is there anything you do or don't want to get into? You know, usually most people are like, yeah, whatever. You know, they don't care. And I was like, okay, cool. All John Hughes movies then, you know, and I was just kind of messing with him, but I hadn't realized he actually grew up in like straight up John Hughes territory, you know, which is funny. It seems like, I don't know. It's like if you grew up watching like Ferris Bueller's and Breakfast Club and Home Alone and all these movies, like you feel like you have this intimate knowledge of Chicago. I used to love that movie Adventures in Babysitting, which is all in Chicago, The Fugitive. I feel like most of my knowledge of Chicago before I started traveling there was all from film, you know?
Right. Well, that's how it is. It's most people's, you know, view of New York City.
I like the fact that he wouldn't give us an answer on Chicago pizza because it's just too controversial. That's fucking funny.
Didn't want to get the house shot up.
I know. But it was really cool for Tim to come on. I'm glad he did. I've known him a long time now, but it's like when we first met, was literally when Rise Against asked Gaslight to open for him. And this was maybe 2008 when Rise Against was really at like the peak of their powers, you know, like they're playing some huge places. And we got asked to open for a tour, which was Rise Against, Alkaline Trio, Thrice, and then us. So this beautiful package, and we were first of four, and it ended up being it's basically a bus tour that we were still in a van for. So, you know, we're basically chasing around three buses on a bus schedule, you know, for that first tour. It was pretty grueling. It was a long tour.
Right.
And, you know, like we're playing at like, you know, 6:15 at like a hockey arena or something.
Right.
But it was my first exposure into like playing and seeing these like bigger things. And I thought that was kind of the way it operated, but in reality, it was just kind of the way, like, Rise Against operated. You know what I mean? Like, they ran, like, a big ship, but there was still, like, guys like Mike Fry working for them and, like, kind of these, you know, legendary old punk rock people that, you know, worked for the band. And those guys, once you get to know them, you're like, oh, you were all punk and hardcore kids, and you just kind of got this famous, you know, And I kind of had a misrepresentation of like what that band was until I got out on tour with them. I thought they were like Strike Anywhere, you know, I was like, oh, they're like an awesome melodic hardcore band. Right. And then I show up to one of these first shows and there's just like 3,000 people and going nuts over their singles. I'm like, whoa, Rise Against is doing the thing, man. This is fucking rad. So it was definitely like that tour was like a learning and teaching moment in like so many ways. Like I got exposed to so much shit I had no idea before that.
Right.
We even like before that we had no Ian Perkins, and we asked Ian to start coming out with us because like basically a month before that tour started, we were like, oh shit, like we don't have anyone on stage for us. Like we were traveling as a five then, which was just, you know, someone to do merch and help out and then us.
Right.
And then we're like, fuck, like in front of like 2,500 people, changing a string on stage is about to look a lot worse. You know what I mean? Like, like, uh-oh, like, is this, and it was kind of like that first time when we were almost like forced to make our thing bigger because of what we were doing, you know, like it kind of gave us an exposure into that world. It was pretty funny, but the tour just ruled, man. I mean, with those bands, it was like one of those marked experiences in my life. Oh. And I thought no one gave a shit. Like it was, you know, one of those tours that, you know, you're playing to a couple hundred people in a really huge room and it looks like nobody's there, but there's actually a few hundred people there, which is at the time was plenty of people for us to play to. And, you know, as the years went on, a lot of people were like, oh, we saw you open up for Rise Against and blah, blah, blah. And we're like, oh, cool. I'm glad people were actually into it. We had no idea.
Right.
But it was like a really like stunning and cool learning experience going on tour Rise Against the first time. It was like, oh, this is how like real bands do it, you know?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But it was awesome for, and you know, because of it, like, you know, I didn't get to get down with people as much, and it kind of took a while to get to know people. And then I think the second time we toured with Rise was really when I understood. I'm like, yeah, Tim's like a really fucking nice guy, you know, like strip all this other stuff back. He's just like really kind and really genuine, and everything he's saying he's totally legitimate about. And I just really started to gain a lot of respect for him in particular.
He's so perceptive. That's what I got from this interview. He's just like, he's on point.
I mean, I guess it's a good thing he's studying sociology. That'll work.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So what do you think? This is a long interview. We should probably not intro too long.
Let's check it out. It's going on
track! Hello, are you guys there?
Hey.
Hey, Tim, we're talking diseases.
Oh, let's talk diseases. Let's start off on the right foot here.
Yeah, but not the one you're thinking of.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was one called rhinovirus.
Oh, that sounds
You ever have experience with that one?
No, it kind of sounds like a really good band name.
I know. Shotgun.
Oh, it's a perfect.
Yeah.
Are you done being a mountain man, Brad? Tim, Brad was just hiding up in the mountains for a couple weeks.
My God.
Doing something.
Super exciting. Where were you?
I went to 3 different locations in northern Vermont, and it was all of them were amazing. It's so... it's just so beautiful up there. They don't have any problem. There's no ticks up there. There's no freaking coronavirus. There's no like.
Right. You need the wilderness.
It was the wilderness. It was pretty sweet.
Were you camping or like hotels or
like we went up and stayed with some family on this lake. They had got a
cool.
Some cousins had got a house on a lake for like the month or something, and we went up for 1 week. And then a friend of mine moved up to a place just above Stowe. And he's like permanently moved up there. And so we stayed with him for a few days. And then we stayed on Lake Champlain at like another friend's freaking mansion.
Really?
Like with his view of that lake. The lake is so big. So.
Where do you get friends that have mansions in Lake Champlain? I don't have any of those.
I want some of those too.
Yeah. I'll blame my wife for that one. That's one of her
friends. Most of Tim and I's friends are dirty tattooed punk rockers who have very
right.
little.
I know. I can go like vacation at an apartment above the Fireside Bowl, maybe. But that's what I got.
I'll grab a 40 and go to.
Yeah. My buddy has the rundown place on the creek that was still pretty freaking sweet, but it was kind of more like camping out. But yeah, so my wife put us in the deluxe accommodations there.
How are you looking right now? Because I'm imagining a real like season 6 Walter White Breaking Bad kind of thing going on.
Dude, I still have not got a fucking haircut since this thing started.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Tim, I noticed, you know, I've seen some stuff you've been posting lately. You look pretty clean. You look pretty clean considering.
I
know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're rocking a beard, but it's like a nicely trimmed beard. The hair looks pretty well kempt. Like, how are you keeping it together there?
I don't know. I'm fooling you then. I'm definitely fooling you on whatever you're looking at, because it's I haven't gotten a proper haircut since this all began either. Like,
okay.
Not that I was getting a lot of proper haircuts before this stuff. Like, my version of a haircut is more or less like I don't do it, and then I'm about to like go to the airport for something, and I look in the mirror and I'm like, oh crap, like. I should do something before this video shoot or this tour that's about to start. And then I look at my wife and she always tells me, you know that I'm not a hairstylist, right? And then we grab a pair of clippers and she tries to make it look good, like decent.
You know, I could use your opinion on that, because I've been running into that issue. I found, because of the quarantine, I've had a stunning realization basically that the only thing that has been my motivation to stay like somewhat in shape and somewhat clean all of these years has been playing shows. It's like, it's like these like potential future dates. I'm like, okay, I got like a tour in 6 weeks. I got a show in a few days. I got this. So maybe I'll skip that eggplant parm, you know, maybe I'll shave on Monday or something. But without these like shows, in the future, I've kind of found that basically I'm awful at motivating myself to take care of myself without this impetus. Have you found this as well?
Yeah, I absolutely relate to that, because the show and the tour and the video and the whatever, that's like our office space, right? So that's like what we get up to go to in the morning to go to the office. And that's why you would brush your hair. That's why you would, you know, maybe like think about what you're wearing. And without that, like when I come home from tour, I don't really, like I'm not seeing a lot of people outside of my family. You know, when I get home from tour, I'm just kind of like, I go back to being a hermit and I just see them. And it's very rare that I really try to like care about my appearance. And so this whole time has been like that. So there's been a handful of things I've had to go do where I'm like, oh wait, I need to look in the mirror here. I'm like going
need to reflect on that. The idea that we can't be motivated to look good for like our wife and children and families.
Yes.
But we'll get it together for a bunch of strangers, you know?
Yes, that's probably a good therapy session rabbit hole.
We'll have a think on that for sure.
We will, yes.
Yeah. So how you doing, man? You're home. You're in Illinois.
Yeah.
Yes.
Home in Chicago. Like everybody else is home, right? Wherever they are.
How's your day to day been? What's been going on over there?
It's been pretty chill. Like we had some pretty intensive like songwriting and a little bit of stuff happening right before the quarantine. And so right as the quarantine started, I was kind of in that sort of like that post emotional collapse of some giant endeavor anyway.
Oh, you know? Right.
And so it sort of dovetailed nicely with my like the quarantine and my emotional collapse. So I was ready to like not see anybody or do anything for a while.
So what date did you actually like wrap up the record?
Well, we haven't really wrapped up anything, but we definitely like have a good like chunk of stuff ready for when the lights go back on.
Gotcha.
But it was all kind of happening around that time. It was like March is when my calendar was opening up anyway. And so my calendar was going to be pretty open in like March, April, May, regardless. And then we were going to start playing some festivals this summer. And so my spring calendar really didn't change. I was doing what I normally do. Like, you know, like we just touched on, I was home. You know, I have two daughters. I have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Okay.
So like I have high school and junior high, you know, they're busy and doing their thing. And so I'm just like family guy when I'm home. And then it wasn't until like this whole lockdown stretched into summer and then we started realizing that shows were happening. That was when my own calendar kind of started to change. And I realized like, okay, this is going to look different, you know?
Right. And you guys are kind of remote writers anyway, right? I mean, it's been many years where, was it Brandon's out in, Colorado? Zach is on the East Coast somewhere, right? So,
Brandon's in Colorado. Zach's in Austin, Texas.
Oh, Austin, right.
Yeah. And Joe and I are here in Chicago. And Joe and I write the bulk of the material. And so, writing remote has sort of been our thing for a long time. Like, we don't all live in the same city, so we don't ever get together like and just play. You know, if we play, it's sort of like we have to orchestrate that to happen somewhere. So we've gotten pretty good at the whole remote writing thing, I think.
What's your method? Like, so you and Joe, you know, get together. What do you guys write stuff on? Do you acoustics? Are you like, how does the inception go? And then how does it get to everyone else for contribution?
So I think we've tried a lot of different stuff in the past. You know, when everybody was in the same town, we would get together in the rehearsal space and just hash stuff out. And then when Brandon left to go back to Colorado, where he grew up, we started doing things more remotely. When Zach joined the band, we told him, don't even leave Austin, dude. You don't need to come to Chicago because what we do is so remote. You can just stay there.
That's cool.
It worked out for everybody. And so Joe and I, well, usually when it's like record writing time, we've got a rehearsal space somewhere and we get together every couple of days and just kind of share ideas back and forth. We're both like kind of cavemen when it comes to like technology and recording.
And you and Joe.
Yeah, totally. Joe and I. So I think like we've slowly coached each other into getting better, you know, like, so
yeah,
I can,
adapting.
Yeah. Like if I can push a few buttons and make something happen. And then if it doesn't happen, I just give up and play an acoustic guitar and go into my voice memo on my iPhone, you know?
Well, you fooled us when you emailed about having Logic in an SM7. I'm like, oh. Tim's got studio guy at home. He's probably got a big thing going on. Yeah.
Oh man, I wish, but like that's probably the extent of my knowledge. But I will say, like the March 2020 Tim and now like the August 2020 Tim is a different Tim. I've learned a lot because I've had time to, first of all,
right,
to kind of finally sit down and figure these things out. And then with this whole like Zoom culture and live streaming. Yeah. And like that kind of stuff. I've never really thought about that because, I mean, I've been really spoiled where I show up somewhere and somebody who's really smart, like it sounds like Brad, you know what you're doing over there. someone like Brad comes in. Yeah, well, it's working well. And they put the mics in the right place and they push the right buttons. And it's my responsibility just to sing and play guitar, you know? And now, I get like a request like, oh, can you do this? And, you know, my instinct is to go say yes. And then, when the day comes, it's like, oh, and you're on your own, like in an empty room, just you and yourself and your guitar, and right. you have to figure out how to make this sound good, you know?
Much more exposed.
Yeah, totally. So like through a lot of coaching and a lot of like frantic text messages to the blasting room in Fort Collins and you know, stuff like that, I've started to like, they've kind of walked me through some things, and so now I have a better idea. I mean, you don't want me producing your record or anything, but I have a better idea of how to put something down into something.
So
digital.
Bill Stevenson is your phone a friend if something happens.
Yeah, you know, Bill's not even that great at this.
Okay, it's not his forte either.
I don't think he wouldn't mind me saying that either. He's sure. The blasting room is such a beautiful place because everyone there kind of serves this different purpose. Like they're all like, they're all the different pieces of Voltron. They come together and make this crazy, crazy machine.
So and then Bill's not the tech guy. He's not your song guy.
He's not IT.
The sound guy.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. He's like, he's more like, I don't know. Yeah. He's definitely more of the arty producer kind of guy, but he's not, he won't call him for IT. That's for sure.
Gotcha. So,
but there are some people over there, that really know what they're doing and are constantly like learning about it. So
that's cool. Well, speaking of which, I'd seen that Bill's done 6 Rise Against albums, right?
That number sounds accurate.
And you went back to him to do this last one as well, correct?
We are working with Bill now.
Yeah. So how did that all start with you guys and Bill, and what's the aspects of like that relationship specifically that make you always, you know, feel comfortable with him and want to go back there?
So our relationship with Bill starts with our second record, Revolutions Per Minute. And it was kind of an accidental meeting in a way. Like we were obviously aware of Bill and the studio. Sure. Yeah. Joe had met him previously and actually had been to the Blasting Room on a previous tour. But when we sat down to do our second record, he wasn't the first choice in doing that record. Okay. And it wasn't, and I'll tell you why. It was Rise Against was a band that when we started, we were very like, I don't know, kind of trying to be cognizant of our identity and like where we fit in. And I guess this information will be like dated, but like in like the year 2000, 2001, you know, we were signed to Fat Records, and like back then there was like Fat Wreck bands and there were Victory bands.
Right.
And there were
Epitaph
bands, you know, and I know that might not mean a lot to somebody who was born that year, you know, but like at the time that was a big deal. And the label you were on.
Yeah, for
sure.
It
was a big deal, and we were coming out.
And each one of those labels you just mentioned had a very like kind of specific sound and culture that went behind it. So I totally know what you're talking about.
Right. So people were going to look at your band in a specific way.
Right.
And we were coming out from under the shadow of Idiot Fingers Louie, Joe's previous band, who was on Hopeless.
Sure.
But when we put Rise Against together, we knew that we were way different than Idiot Fingers Louie, and we were way different than like a lot of the bands on those same rosters that they were living on. And we wanted to be taken seriously as our own band. So we were like, honestly, we were trying to pivot more into like a hardcore world, you know, away from like a pop punk world.
Sure.
We felt like our band could be taken seriously in that world.
The inventors of pop punk wasn't the exact look.
Totally. We were already on Fat Records, which was the greatest thing to be on. But we were touring with a lot of Fat Records bands. But we were also out with Boys It's Fire, and we were out with Thursday, and we were out with that was the same tour actually, Thursday and Boys It's Fire. We were going out with a lot of bands like Reach the Sky.
And
trying to get those records or those that world take us seriously, and Victory was a place that we were trying to sign to before Fat Records came along, and this was 2001 or no this was 2000 I guess, so it was like before we all knew a lot about Victory Records,
right.
Like what goes on behind the scenes. To me, it was just like, this is the label that has Earth Crisis and Snapcase and Refuse and Guilt and By the Grace of God, and this is everything that comes into Chicago. It has a Victory stamp on it. I'm loving, you know? So let's be taken seriously in that world, you know?
Man, Charles Bronson was really ahead of their time getting on Victory Records. They knew something was going on there before like the... pre-emo explosion of like 9, you know, record contracts and stuff started popping up.
Oh my God. Yeah. Right. Leave it. Charles Bronson were trendsetters. That's for sure.
Oh, that's a fact. I still rock the shirt. People think sometimes that I'm wearing a shirt of myself on it because based on our subsequent conversation about being a scum ass. There are certain days I can look like some version of a dirty Charles Bronson.
Charles Bronson is one of those bands where I thought it was just like a Chicago thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like an Illinois thing. And until I got outside of Chicago, I was like, oh, people know. Like, that's
really
cool.
I'd say there are probably like 10 to 20 people in every city in America who have a deep love for Charles Bronson, but probably no more than 10 to 20 outside of Chicago. Yeah.
I think you're probably right.
But for anyone listening to this right now, go ahead and go get Youth Attack by Charles Bronson and school yourself on some old school good Chicago shit. So
amen.
So you're talking about Bill Stevenson and
we were trying to make the right decisions, and you know, Bill didn't come up in that conversation of doing our second record. And so we had just heard, I think what was it, Hot Water Music's Caution had come out.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. And we were like, oh, well, we got to go to Brian McTernan. That sounds amazing.
Right.
And then through like actually a really weird series of miscommunications, like we thought we were going to Brian McTernan, and Brian McTernan was like, you guys were never coming here.
Whoa,
you
know? Really?
Yeah, I wouldn't blame him. I think that it was like, this is pre-management. You know what I mean? It was like one guy in the band had a cell phone. You know, we were doing things very much like, even though we were on Fat, like it was still a lot of just DIY stuff happening.
Yeah.
So it just got lost in the shuffle, and the date was rolling around, and we were like, well, shit, where are we going to go? And we're like, well, maybe actually Steve Ebbets came up in the conversation because he had done, I think, that most recent Sick of It All record on Fat that sounded epic.
Yeah,
and a lot of great records. Those Turmoil records that he did back in the day are like some of my favorite records. And then we were just too late, you know, because it was now rolling around. And so we called the Blasting Room and we said, can you squeeze us in? And they did. And I'm so glad we did, because the long story short here is we met like our soulmate in like music, which is Bill Stevenson, Jason Livermore, Andrew Berlin. Like that studio was really where we were meant to make music. They became a part of our band. Like, I don't think of, we talked about like the band being like your office, you know, and like how that's when you walk out. Like if there was anything that was more like, if there was any physically manifested Rise Against place that felt like the place that our business takes place in, it's walking into the Blasting Room. It's become like, it feels like our headquarters, even though it's their headquarters, you know, it feels like family when we walk in there.
Such a nice thing to have. It's cool.
it really was special. Yeah. And we only learned that really when we, I think we went to Bill, then we left Bill for our major label debut. And then we, that was when it was kind of the typical, like, you don't know what you got till it's gone kind of thing. Like, oh, we thought every producer and experience was going to be as amazing as this experience. And we realized that wasn't the case.
Who did you guys work with for that record?
We worked with Garth Richardson, who he had done a lot of, well, he had actually just done that From Out of the Ashes record at the time. Before that, he had done things for like Chili Peppers and Trapped, and he was doing a lot of that kind of like Canadian active rock kind of stuff, you know?
Okay.
And the label, so the label was excited about that because he was, you know, was a commercially proven producer. Right. And we were excited because he had From Out of the Ashes on his resume, and he had Sick of It All's Built to Last in his resume. And I guess, I don't know why I'm forgetting this, but Garth did the first Rage Against the Machine record
too. Oh, okay, yeah.
So I probably should have mentioned that first. And so those were all things where, like, well, this was a producer that, you know, he's like a big ticket producer. We're signing to a major label as a bunch of kids. We're probably going to get dropped in 6 months right now. And so let's take this blank check and do the whole major studio experience that you get to do before the label drops you, you know?
Do you think there is anything that, you know, like the fact that you guys were, you know, were and had always been like politically motivated? Do you think they were trying to like grab some like Rage fans and like get into like that world a little bit with that choice?
I think that's probably factored into their decision as well. The fact that Garth had done the first Rage, the label was excited about the political side of our band. It was like who we were, and the guy that signed us, Ron Handler, who I'm trying to think of the band. Ron signed we signed to DreamWorks, and Ron had signed, I think, Alien Ant Farm, Papa Roach, Power Man 5000. Did he sign Sparta? I don't remember if he signed, if they were on DreamWorks. But that was a time when Jimmy Eat World was on DreamWorks and Save the Day was on DreamWorks and AFI had signed to DreamWorks.
Right.
Juliana Theory was like Sony. And so this seemed like a place to be. We were like, we were excited about being there. A lot of our peers were there. And so Garth became the guy. And we actually had a lovely time with Garth recording the record, and like the bass and drums were done in Brian Adams' studio, The Warehouse, in Gastown in downtown Vancouver.
That's a sweet studio.
Oh my God. I mean, can you imagine, like, I don't think I've seen a sweeter studio since. Yeah. So like, that was my first experience. I was like, oh, this whole rock thing is going to be great. Like, look at the studio, you know? Like, I don't think I've ever seen a studio that amazing since. But yes, doing the bass and drums there was like incredible. And then we went out to his island north of Vancouver in Horseshoe Bay. You had to take a ferry to get out to this island called Gibson's. And we recorded like in his big cabin on his property, like on a hill, for the next like month and a half.
That's so perfect. You guys signed to a major and did the thing.
We totally did the thing. You know what I mean? I mean, we were still like sharing hotel rooms, and like on the island, we lived in a cabin where we all slept in like beds that were on the same, in one big room. But like, yes, it felt like fucking rock star, you know?
Yeah.
Like there was like a girl at the front desk of the warehouse that would like, she kept offering to run errands for us. You know what I mean? And like, no one had ever run an errand for me before. You know what I mean? So I was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, what do you, whatever you like, food? You want to go, I want to go buy some records. And we're like, what is this? This is crazy. You know?
We have a slave.
Is this how it's going to be from now on?
No. That's exactly. The blasting room doesn't have that girl at the front desk.
So what was it about like moving forward? You know, what does Bill help you with songwriting and sound and, or, you know, the way you feel? Like, what are the things that he's really bringing for you guys that bring it up another notch?
That's a great question. I think all four of us would answer it kind of differently, but he's definitely like he's a rise against whisperer for each of us, which is super important. Like, I don't think that like he favors one of us over the other, or he just is because he's a drummer, like him and Brandon do the drums and that's the thing, or because, you know, he's played in a band with Carl Alvarez, like Joe's bass playing like blows him away. Because he's known Zach since Zach was like 15 or 16, because Hagfish did some of the first records at the Blasting Room.
I see.
So he knew Zach before us. And then for me, like, him and I have connected like really deeply. Like, we go on vacation together. You know what I mean? Like, I go out to Fort Collins when I have time off to like spend time with him. Like,
that's cool.
I was just texting with him this morning about like books and podcasts and that kind of thing. So, my lyrics are something that he's really, I just feel like he really understood, but also isn't afraid to like hold my feet to the fire and like
get in there.
Like, he'll question things I'm writing sometimes. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whether it's like really conceptual, whether he's like, I don't think I agree with this idea you're talking about, you know, or just something as like, I don't think you said this well enough. You know, like, I think you could say this better, or, you know, God, he's such a great bullshit detector. Like, I'll be like, say like a song is like 16 bars of lyrics, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting there trying to wrap up the last like two. I have 14 great lines that I love, and I can't get the last two, and I've been putting the whole song off forever, and it's finally coming. And so I just kind of like, maybe I kind of phone it in a little bit, because I'm like, you know what? 14 great lines are great. Like, that's who needs 16 great lines. Like, yeah. I just need to get this done. Everyone's waiting for me. I'll go in there. And not knowing which one of those two lines I phoned in, and me just sitting in the vocal booth crossing my fingers that he doesn't notice.
Yeah, right.
He'll notice. He'll pull out. I'm like, and he says the nicest way too. Like, Tim, when you say this line here, and I'll be like, oh, fuck you, Bill. I can't believe I almost snuck this by you, you know? And so
that's awesome.
The fact that like we speak that language, you know, that he can do that. I'm so grateful for it. I'm so pissed in the moment because I got to go back and do my homework.
Sure.
Like, I'm so grateful that like that's a guy who's paying attention
to what
you're doing. That's a guy who like when he left his house and walked into that studio, he put everything like outside that door when he closed that door.
Sure.
And he is, his phone is off and he is focused on that song in ways that like sometimes the four of us aren't even focused on that song, you know, because we're distracted as well, you know, and he just gets into it and then cares about it, understands it, which is important for me as like a lyricist, and knows like what I'm trying to do and what I'm trying to say. And he's also, you know, Bill's a lyricist too. Yeah, he writes a lot of the Descendants lyrics. Very good. Yeah, like people, I guess if they don't know Bill Stevenson, he's was the drummer of Black Flag and then created the Descendants and is the drummer in that band, but he's also like a predominant songwriter in that band and then obviously an amazing producer. He's an incredible drummer, but he's a guitar player. He can play every instrument. He can do everything. He's also a thinking man, so he comes up with really important, interesting concepts for lyrics and that kind of thing. So it makes him really well suited to be a producer because he wears a lot of hats, you know?
Right. And apparently drinks more coffee than any man I've
ever heard. He absolutely drinks way too much coffee. I think the last time I saw, I guess it was Flag, which was playing at the Double Door a couple of years ago. And Flag, if people don't know, is basically all of Black Flag, but without Greg Ginn. And but we walked into a coffee shop before the show, and he asked for, 10 shots of espresso?
Oh my God.
And I'm not a coffee drinker, but like, I know, like, I'm like, okay, that seems like a lot. And we were in this coffee shop in Wicker Park, and they just looked at him and they were like, we're not doing that. Because he wanted 10 shots of espresso all in the same cup.
Right.
And he's like, we're not doing that. And he just was like, what? He just like, his whole
mainframe. They refused to serve. Wow.
Yeah, they refused to serve. And he was like, they're like, we'll sell you 10 shots, but we're not going to put it all in the same cup. And he was like, what's the difference? Just make the 10 shots and put it like in the cup. And like, I remember I was walking into the coffee shop as he was storming out. And like, Bill doesn't get mad. Bill doesn't get angry. He just gets flabbergasted. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, he's not going to like go all like Karen on somebody.
He's California.
Just like,
Yeah.
Surfer. Whoa, what? The guy just said he wouldn't do it. Whoa. Wait a minute. Did you hear him? Did he just say that? Did you hear him say that? You know? And that's what he was doing before Flag shows. It was just like insane amounts of coffee. Yeah, he's the best, dude. He's like, I don't know, like the words like mentor or like guru or like, you know, almost like a father figure, but also a peer. But then also, it helps that he's a hero of mine. You know, he was on my mixtapes growing up, you know? Right. And so he's a larger-than-life character. Like, when you see the movie where the comic book character comes to life and the kid's like, oh my God, you're real, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's still building me, because I was, you know...
Sure.
I had a Walkman and a skateboard, and Milo Goes to College, and I was sending cash to SST Records for Black Flag 7-inches that he played on.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
So that's to be there with this guy who is not just amazing at what he does, but also one of my heroes. I want his approval. I crave his approval, you know?
And I think you mentioned something that, like, I think it's lost on some people trying to produce and engineer sometimes, which is, like, you know, that psychological element of it where, you know, especially, you know, someone who's a vocalist, you know, you're bearing your fucking soul.
Yes.
You know, it's emotional.
Yeah.
It's a thing. And if there's someone sitting on the other side of that glass that looks a little checked out, not invested in your words or the process,
yeah,
like, that's a stark reminder of vulnerability, you know? Like, producers got to be, like, engaged and with it and with you, you know, like, through the whole thing. And I think people forget how important that is.
Yeah, yeah, that's a super wise observation, for sure. Because the vocal booth is this place where I don't care who you are, like, you're really vulnerable in there. And not just the words you've poured down into, you know, on pen and paper, but, you know, your voice alone. You know, you're trying a new song, you're trying things that you didn't do before, and you're going to have, like, there's nothing more embarrassing to, like, sing something that doesn't work, you know what I mean?
Right,
or to hit the wrong notes, or to have the voice crack. You know what I mean? Those are sounds that human beings make that other human beings are, like, it's in our DNA to cringe at.
Right, your ears, like, if you hit a bad note on a guitar, it's like, eh. But if, yeah, you
right.
hear a bad note on vocals, you're like, what was that? Your ears perk up. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Like, just like we know not to eat something that smells like feces. You know what I mean? to our body, through years of evolution, has rejected like that. Like, we know that's why we stay away from it. We hear those sounds of, like, a vocalist, you know, sounding like a dying dog. And it just,
this,
like,
sound is bad for my health.
Yeah. Totally. You just, and so as a vocalist, you want to not make those sounds.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And with Bill, he's so, you know, he's in tune, not just to, like, my physical health of my voice, but also, you know, the lyrics are a whole different side of it as well.
I've wondered that with vocalists, because, I mean, I couldn't, the vocal booth is the most fucking terrifying place in the world to me. Hmm. You know, even just hearing my voice just talking on a recording, I start to cringe. So the idea of, you know, like, listening to myself extremely unskilled sing is, like, I don't know, that's like a top five most embarrassing thing you could do to me. But like, I always wonder in that situation, you know, you're singing really, like, poignant stuff that when you write it really is means a lot to you and is tugging from a place of, like, emotion and heart, and then you walk into, like, a studio, you walk into a room, and it's cold, and it's empty and quiet, and there's, you know, some eyes on the other side of a board, like, meticulously looking at every single thing you say. Like, what are the types of things that you do personally to, like, get yourself either worked up or, like, calmed down for that situation? Like, do you have any, like, tools or things you do to kind of, like, hype yourself up or calm yourself down before you get in the booth like that?
That's a good question. I think when I'm recording, I don't require that sort of, like, process to get hyped up. Like, I think I just,
okay,
I walk in there and Bill kind of knows, like, without much fanfare, he's just going to start playing the song, you know? And I'm
right.
And he's not even going to tell me if he's recording it or not, you know? And if I'm struggling, he kind of knows just what to say to, like, get me to, like, keep doing it, you know, without pointing out the elephant in the room, like, Tim, you sound terrible. You know what I mean?
Right.
But he knows, I think, from working not just with me, but with lots of vocalists, like, there are certain things that you say. He's got all kinds of, like, I wish I could think of some of them, like, great psychological, like, I think producers are also, like, kind of like psychiatrists, you know?
100%, yeah.
And so, they know what to say. I'm starting to figure out his code words for that sucked. You know,
right.
It's sort of like are you guys baseball fans at all?
I am.
Certainly, Ben
okay.
is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, like, there's times when like a pitcher is pitching and he's struggling, and you'll see the catcher like call like a timeout or walk to the mound and talk to the pitcher, and I like. Sometimes that conversation is really important to the game, and there's something like in the strategy that's happening there. But when you talk to catchers and pitchers or ball players in general, you'll learn that like sometimes he's just doing that because he knows that pitcher needs like a beat to skip. He needs a moment.
Yes.
Yeah. And so he might walk out there and just be like, "Dude, lunch sucked. How about that? Did you get that burger?
Right.
A catering? That was awful. They gotta make a better burger. Yeah, I know. All right, man. Let's go back in it." You know, like, sometimes that catcher is just giving that pitcher a moment to just reset, and he's doing he's using the walk as an excuse. And Bill's great at doing things. He'll blame the computer sometimes. He'll like blame, he'll like get self deprecating and be like, "Oh, dude, I totally messed up. You gotta do that again." You know what I mean? Or like, I need a few minutes, Tim. Like, this thing crashed on me because he knows that I need a few minutes, but he also knows that, like, if he tells me I need a few minutes, that might be so like mentally devastating that I might not come back to perform it at 100% that afternoon, you know? Wow. And so it's like, I would love to talk to producers about all their magic tricks because I can tell it's been a long time. Cause like he fooled me before when I was younger, but now I know his magic tricks, but I also, it doesn't bother me that he's still using them. You know what I mean? Because It makes me know that like he's aware, but he's not trying to like get up in my face.
That's right. Like, so you kind of almost know in the moment that your emotions are being manipulated, but you don't mind.
Oh yeah. At this point I can tell, cause Bill's like, it's like when they say that you know, when you're countering something, you should respond, not react, you know? Mm-hmm. You should respond to something and not react to something. Like, Bill's great at just responding, but not reacting. He's great at, like, that poker face. Like, you could tell him something totally insane, and he'd be great at, like, just letting it sink in and then thinking about what's the best way I respond to Tim's totally insane thing he just said, you know? But once you get to know a person, you can see in their eyes when they think you're insane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's times where I'm like, okay, Bill, don't bullshit me. I know you disagree with whatever I just said, you know?
Yeah.
Which is usually about where we're going for lunch, but.
That's awesome, man. Well, yeah, when we were setting this up, I was joking with you and saying that I found the Baxter demo online, your old band, when you were a young man.
Yes.
And the demo tape had the house line, your phone number on the front of it, which you still said is an active number in your household, which is hilarious.
my mom would love to talk to you.
it was making me think, you know, I didn't want to text all that, but, you know, I was a show promoter when I was a kid, and, you know, I only had my mom's phone number to give to people for information. And on show days, I would literally have my mom parked up at the phone at my house, answering calls, explaining to people how to get to the Manville Elks Lodge from all 4 points, north, west, south, and east, you know, like of where we lived. And I left her directions, and that's what we had to do.
That's a solid mom, too, by the way.
Yeah, it was solid. She had a funny one. Best story with that was when I was trying to book the Get Up Kids when they were really, you know, this is like mid-90s when they're just starting. Yeah. And I get a message from my mom that says, "Matt from the Ghetto Kids called." And then, you know what? I called back Matt. I think it was Matt Pryor. And I told him that story. And he barely laughed. And then I wrote off the Get Up Kids for like 2 years. Because I was like, that shit's funny, man. You should have laughed.
Come on, Matt. That's pretty funny.
So it just made me laugh seeing that demo and seeing, you know, getting that stark reminder of what doing this was like in the 90s. Like, can you explain to someone, you know, who's 18 years old right now, like, what that process was like for you? Like, how did, when you were a kid, when you were in high school, how were you recording the demos and putting it out? How were you promoting yourself? Like, what were some of the things that you used at the time that are, you know, totally antiquated now?
Right. Oh my God. Yeah. It's so, I mean, you know, especially if you're a promoter, you know, because I was trying to get a hold of people like you, you know,
right.
promoters.
Yeah.
And that was through the mail.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean? So there's no internet, you know, or if there is an internet, it's not something that anybody's really on or finding very useful.
No,
right. Because it's slow and nobody's really on it. There's not a lot of resources on there. It's kind of just a party trick, you know?
Right. At that point. Yeah.
At that point. Yeah. So you are, and punk rock is small and it's not in magazines, you know, and it's not on TV and the underground scenes are small and you kind of got to figure out how your way into them. And that's a lot of, oh, geez. I mean, it's recording your own music, finding a studio that can do it, you know, making your own cassette, like that cassette that you saw, like we found a cassette maker in town,
okay.
you know, this tiny place in this little industrial area. And we bought those like labels at like an Office Depot or whatever, you mm-hmm. know, and put them into a typewriter,
right.
you know?
Oh, nice.
And, yeah. And each one of them, like we hand typed out, you know? And I remember my
so that's how you got that really nice typewriter font on that demo.
They really are yeah. typewriters. You know, we didn't figure out the word processing thing until I think it was Neil Hennessy's mom. Neil from the Lawrence Arms was in the band with
right.
me. And I think his mom was like, you know, there's an easier way to do this. And so we like figured that out. And then we would, you know, make those tapes. And then obviously, you know, now you would put that music online, but back then that wasn't an option. So we made maybe 100 of those cassettes. And then we were just young punk skate kids, which was a small scene in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. And so it was small enough where there's only a handful of you in one high school, a handful of you in another high school. And so
right.
you were friends with other high schools. And so we were part of like a big kind of friend group of just freaks, you know?
Okay.
And so I remember giving a shoebox of those cassettes to the guy I knew at the neighboring high school.
Oh,
and
nice.
The shoebox access okay. to the other high school, and so I had them at like four high schools.
That's funny. Wow.
That were so like, and then I told him I was like, if you can get any money, like if you could charge like you know $4 or $5 for this, see if anybody wants it. You know,
that's pretty funny. You were like hiring consultants in like different high schools.
they were just you know friends that I was like, go do this. And those yeah. see, we do the same thing with like shows in a basement. Is like I'd go to like Kinko's or wherever and make copies, and then. Hand a stack to, like, I would try to hand a stack to, like, four different high schools, and then
right.
maybe, like, the local skate shop and the local record store.
Sure.
And what's funny about that is that you'd never get any feedback, right?
Like, no.
like
yeah.
Those cassettes, I think they all eventually went, but you never hear, like, who got them, if
no.
they liked
yeah.
them,
yeah. Yeah, yeah,
put
yeah.
them away. And, in fact, that's how I met Neil Hennessy from the Lawrence Arms. He was at a neighboring high school, and before he was in Baxter... We had about six songs on a cassette that we were doing the same thing with. He had that cassette, but I didn't know Neil. I didn't know he had that cassette.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And he didn't know me. Like he thought like we were some. He was telling me he thought like we were like a real established band.
Right.
When he heard it,
yeah.
You know,
if someone had a demo out at that time, that was almost like if you had a demo and a T-shirt at that time, you were
yeah.
You were like on your way up. Like you were
totally.
Yeah,
that's as established as it gets. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and then from there it was. You know, if you remember the book, Your Own Fucking Life.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, so I had
that
a copy
was what
of that.
Maximum Rock and Roll would... Was that once a year they would put it out?
Yeah.
Yeah, they put out a... For, again, for the youth who might be listening,
right.
Maximum Rock and Roll would release something called Book Your Own Fucking Life that had contacts of different promoters or maybe, like, record stores and stuff in almost every city in America. And then, yeah, you just... had the chance to shop it. I guess it was like a punk rock phone book almost.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like the Yellow Pages for
yeah.
every state. And so Illinois wasn't a big chapter in Illinois.
Right.
But there was a handful of things in Chicago. And I would just send out this thing to anybody who would listen and then send it out to like promoters like yourself, I'm sure, who are like, oh, we do shows in Iowa City.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I would send demos and be like, cool, book us, you know, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Detroit, Indianapolis, and I met people that way, and we were writing letters back and forth, and that's how some shows happened.
And you were getting out to these cities in high school?
Yeah, high school, and then in my first year of college or two, I went to college in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
so I stayed in the city, and then the band kind of continued, but we were fizzling at that point. like we were just kind of starting to lose members and losing the drive to do it, you know?
Right. I mean, what were your spots back then? Like, were you playing, was it like basement Elks type of situations out in the suburbs, or were you actually getting into the city and playing?
So we started in the suburbs for sure. A lot of like house parties. You know, it's weird about being in a band where I was such a fan of like punk rock and hardcore, and I never, and my band started and Baxter started, and Baxter to me, when we started, like, we didn't sound like everything else that was happening. You know what I mean? Like, I look back and I'm like, I'm sure we just, we did, you know, I'm sure we did sound like everything else. But like, sure. At the time, I remember thinking like, I remember thinking a combination of like, we don't sound like what I'm listening to. And then I almost admit being like a little like, we don't fit into this world. Like, okay. we're not good enough for that world. Like, that's, there's the places that I go see shows are different, in a different place and a better place than the places that I'm like making music with my friends in. Like, that's that, I almost thought as like, that's like, higher education. You know what I mean?
But
I'm still like in high school, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so it was like a really defeatist kind of attitude towards it. And so we were ambitious, but like only so ambitious, because I don't think we thought we belonged in that Chicago scene. And then we
started getting, kind of like exclusionary? Was there kind of like a cooler than you thing going on? Or
no, I don't think so. It was just, I don't know. It was just, I had, even though I was like into punk rock, I hadn't really, to me, there was like a real barrier between the people on the floor and the people on the stage. And I always saw myself as a person on the floor, not a person on the stage, you know? And so, like, my heroes were like Cap'n Jazz, you know? And like, there was a band called Psychicato that was happening around Chicago, and like, Apocalypse Hoboken was playing, and the Bull Weevils. And I just saw it as like, that was such a cool crowd, you know?
Right.
And we weren't good enough for that, you know? But slowly, Chicago really started to embrace us. And so we were opening for like Good Riddance and Ensign at the Fireside Bowl.
Nice.
We were the opener for like Avail and Discount at the Fireside. You know, we played with Strife.
nice.
We played, yeah, well, I was straight edge, or I am straight edge. And so like that hardcore world was like, still, as much as I loved like all the, like this, the punk world I was going to see, but I was the kid that was also going to the Snapcase shows and the Earth Crisis shows and the Integrity shows and that kind of thing. And that was the other thing too, was like, my band did not sound like Snapcase or Earth Crisis or Integrity. And so I had a lot of, I don't know, like self-doubt because of that.
I
need to be in a tougher band. Like, like, to be a straight edge hardcore kid, your band's got to sound like these bands, you know?
Yeah.
And So when I picked up a guitar, that's not what I played or not what I wrote. And so I saw myself as kind of not part of that scene. But yeah, like we played, but we also played like Slapstick's final shows at the Fireside, which were huge. So we definitely, like, towards the end of our whole thing, we were getting a lot of legs, but I don't think that we knew what to do with those legs, you know?
Yeah,
It was, and then we were also losing some like key members that were, it was a family of a band, you know?
So
it didn't feel like a family anymore. And so we were really just doing it for fun. And when it wasn't fun anymore, we kind of hung it up.
And what was going on in Chicago in like the early to mid 90s? It seemed like there was a real kind of hotbed of activity between punk and hardcore, and a lot of really well-known bands and people kind of wound up coming out of that scene. Like, what was going on in Chicago at that time that made it such a hotbed of activity like that?
That's a great question. I mean, Fireside was definitely like the epicenter of that.
Sure.
Because before Fireside, you know, we were all Elks Lodges and Knights of Columbus Halls and basements and random party houses. You know, we had established venues like Metro, but Metro was 1,100 cap, you know, so it's too big for a lot of
people. Couldn't crack the Metro yet,
Exactly. That was a big deal. And so Fireside became an epicenter. And so that, I felt like it helped kind of make those scenes more tight-knit to have a regular place that shows were happening. And every night could be different. You know, you could have the hardcore straight edge, you know, night on Monday night. And then the next one would be like the gutter punk bands would play. And the next one would be like all of the really indie rock stuff that was happening in Chicago might play, or the emo bands like Braid,
right?
Or Cap'n Jazz,
the
or
you know, on too.
All the many post Cap'n Jazz side projects will all be playing like every night, you know. So
yeah, one of them. Yeah,
and I was like a Fireside rat. Like when I left high school and I was, you know, I graduated high school, I was 18, and I moved right into the city, and I got I moved into a house that was near the Fireside. Pretty much. And that was my goal, was just to go to shows. I mean,
and
I
was, that was intentional. You wanted to get a place by the Fireside.
Yeah. I wanted to be close to like shows. Yeah. And sure, so it was a punk house, you know, I lived with a bunch of like punk kids. We had bands sleep over on our floors.
That's not the nicest neighborhood in the world too, especially then,
no,
right?
It wasn't that nice. I was like maybe a mile north of there, 2 miles north of there. So it was fine, but it was, like, and I didn't, at that point of your age, like you don't really care about nice or not nice.
Give a
you know?
Shit.
Yeah. Totally, yeah. And like, I'm like, and you're just like, I don't know. I went through my adolescence through the lens of like a white male, right? So
yeah.
Danger is different to me. And now I realize like, oh, like these neighborhoods are dangerous to someone who maybe was not me, but there were so many shows, so many bands. I think even your boy Brian Fallon said he slept on my floor once, even though we never met.
Because he did. He was in a band called Lane Meyer that toured with Lawrence Arms.
That's totally right. Yeah, because Neil and I lived together in that house when Lawrence Arms was starting.
Because when Gaslight first started playing, Brian had a bunch of like good personal connections in Chicago. That I didn't know that were his connections from the Lane Meyer days, you know, staying at Amber's house and stuff.
Okay.
That definitely wouldn't surprise me. Because one of the early times we went there, I think we may have stayed at Neil's apartment in Chicago somewhere. Yeah.
So that might have been my house even, or it was maybe, well, because Neil moved out after that. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We had like, I remember Newfound Glory staying there, like that band, like Elliot from Louisville, like stayed there once. So we were all just making music and seeing music. And I think that, so to answer your question, like how did Chicago like create all this stuff? Like I think part of what's happening, just a really, really good momentum in terms of like a scene that had regular shows and lots of opportunity to play. And so around that time, like when Baxter broke up, I joined, Arma Angelus, which with Pete Wentz.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so Pete and I were in this band. I was the bass player and he was the singer. And it was like just kind of really technical, hardcore, like in the vein of like Creationist Crucifixion or like Abnegation or like those kind of bands, you know?
Because all his bands at the time were super heavy, yeah.
Yeah, so I had known Pete for a long time and he had like Firstborn and Culture of Violence and they were all hardcore bands. Metal, hardcore, vegan, straight edge bands, you know? And so we were doing that. I also was in, was this after? I also played bass in the Honor System, which was...
Did you really?
Yeah. So I was their first bass. I was the first bass player in the Honor System. So Chicago had the Broadways. Right. And the Broadways and Baxter played a lot together. And then when the Broadways broke up, they formed the Lawrence Arms and they formed the Honor System.
Right.
I remember going to a party after they broke up and all the guys in the Broadways were all there. And at that same party, Brendan cornered me and asked me to start a band with him. And then after he walked away, Dan Hanaway cornered me and asked me to start a band with them. And that's at the same exact
party.
You're
so sought after. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I was like, what is happening? And so I was like, oh, I'm going to go. I don't know what to do here. And they all kind of hated each other at that moment when they were breaking up too. So it was really awkward. Right. So it was like picking a parent in a divorce kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was interesting for me and Neil too, because we grew up together. And what would happen is I would join the Honor System and he would join the Lawrence Arms, you know?
Right.
And this is all there. Back then, it was a kind of a heightened sort of rivalry between the two.
Obviously,
I mean, it was just a heightened post band breakup. I think,
sure,
you know,
yeah.
And I didn't really have a horse in the race, right? Because I just loved all the guys in the Broadways. Thought both bands were great. My best friend was playing drums for the Lawrence Arms, you know, and I was playing bass in the Honor System. But those guys weren't necessarily like on like speaking terms. Like you wouldn't see them playing shows together. And I think that all eventually dissipated it. And I think they're all bros now, but at the time it was like, oh, like like our parents just got divorced and Neil went with mom and I went with dad.
Yeah.
And we were still living in the same house like at that time too. So yeah, I did their first demo. If you could find the Honor System's first demo, I actually sing lead vocal on an entire song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, called Single File.
No shit. Yeah. Honor System's good group. People should check them out if you don't know.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was great. It was a very like. It was like very like. I don't know. I thought it was like a Jets to Brazil kind of vibe or whatever. And I really enjoyed. Yeah. I never played like bass. I was playing bass like in that band, and it was a lot of fun. And so, but it wasn't where my heart wasn't in that band, and my heart wasn't in Army Angels either. And so, that's kind of when Rise Against started. Was like shortly after all that.
That's awesome. Speaking of Chicago, give me please. Your favorite all-time Chicago band.
Okay.
Your favorite all-time Chicago food.
Ooh.
And your favorite all-time Chicago movie. I know I was joking with you about John Hughes.
Right, yeah. Holy crap. Okay, the band is easy. It's Peg Boy.
Ugh, very nice.
Just so good. Stands the test of time.
Sure does.
The recordings, the songwriting. I mean, that's kind of... It's funny you asked like what gets me into like ready for like to do vocals in a studio, or I'll add to that like what I do to get ready before I go on stage. I sing Peg Boy songs. I grab an acoustic guitar, and they really are. They're kind of like my Beatles. You know what I mean? Like they're really. I don't know. It was just a really special band and a special time in Chicago. Their shows were magical. You know.
Yeah, I never got to see him in that time. What do you think would be a good Peg Boys starting off thing for people to listen to if they wanted to get into it? Just get right into Field of Darkness? Or
yeah, anything off Strong Reaction. Just start with Strong Reaction. That's the first song off the record, you know. That's really good stuff, great lyrics. I don't know. I have this dream of like doing like an acoustic album of only Peg Boy songs.
Oh fuck yeah.
Cuz not only cuz I'm doing that in like a backstage shower bathroom like before a show most nights anyway when I'm on tour. But so I get some like hearing them and I'm like, oh, this would be great. But also just like I think I don't know, I want people to know how good the songs are. You know what I mean? And I think they're great. I would prefer Peg Boy play them, but I feel like sometimes when you cover a song, you could really kind of gateway drug somebody into a band.
Sure.
And
if I recall, like, didn't you play a Peg Boy song on one of the tours we did? Didn't Rise Against cover a Peg Boy song?
I'm sure we did.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know which song we would have done or what you're talking about, but we do that all the time. So, yeah. Like we're sound checking to it. You know, we're always.
That might have been it. Yeah, I feel like my ears perked up one day, and I was like, ooh.
Yeah, totally. One of our sound check go tos is like probably. Through My Fingers, you know, songs like that. So, you said favorite band. That's Peg Boys, without a doubt.
Okay, give me food. Give me Chicago food. We going dogs? We going pizza?
Oh my gosh, both are pretty amazing. And like, I guess I gotta go do the deep dish pizza.
Now, what's your spot? Because I've been hearing a lot of different stuff recently.
Yeah, and you will, and you'll always hear different spots. They're all great, and they're all different. I think like my gym is Lou Malnati's.
Okay,
That's just like, but I mean, I won't turn down like a slice from Chicago's. You know, I won't turn down Giordano's. Pequod's is like a whole different vibe, but it's also good. It doesn't even belong in the same category.
So where do you land, though? I had just, for my other podcast, I just did an interview with a guy named Robert Mays, who's a tried and true Chicago guy, and he's a sports writer. And I asked him the pizza question. Now, every time I go to Chicago, I go to Giordano's. That's what it's called, right? Giordano's?
Giordano's.
Yeah, Giordano's. I always go there because I got it the first time I was there. Yeah. I was like, this is one of the best fucking things I've ever tasted in my mouth ever.
Totally.
I don't care what it is. You know, I don't even know if it's pizza. I just know I like it. And I always ordered that. And he had kind of a strong stance that that is not Chicago pizza. And that if it's stuffed, it's not Chicago. And that you need the crispness of the pan... deep dish style to designate it Chicago pizza. Where do you land on that argument?
Oh my God. Dude, I grew up in this town. I gotta live in this town.
Oh, so you're not even allowed to draw a line?
I don't know how far you want to go down this rabbit hole. You know,
yeah.
I think it's, you know, these are fighting words. You know, I
gotta, you could lose fans with the wrong answer here.
I gotta have neighbors that still like me. You know, I don't want to have to hire security. You know, or new whole security system. It's all, it's dicey here
in
Chicago.
Take a stand, man. You know. You've always been so lukewarm in your feelings.
It's easier to take on international politics than it is to take on Chicago's feeling towards pizza.
Yeah, you have like protest and riot videos, and you won't give me an opinion on Chicago pizza. That says something. It really does.
Those people are dangerous, man. I don't want to ruffle those feathers.
It's really funny.
I think, you know, God bless whatever pizza you like in Chicago. Everyone's making really good stuff. If it's still there. After all these years, and there's variety in our pizza. There's like, people aren't just trying to recreate one slice; they're trying to do different things, and that's what's cool about it. And so, when you come to town, do the touristy thing, get your big slice from like Pizzeria Uno or, you know, Giordano's or wherever else, and then ask the locals, and they'll send you to Pequod's. But then, if you go to Pequod's, someone might tell you, "Yeah, but the guy that used to own Pequod's has a place three doors down, and you got to go there."
And then
you go to that spot, and like, what you're going to find is a different kind of pizza in every place, and that's a beautiful thing. That variety is a beautiful thing. You know, go to the Art of Pizza on Western Avenue, across from the old Atlas Studios, and like, that's an amazing pizza. It doesn't taste like Giordano's, but it's like, it's really good. I like that. I like that people in Chicago are trying different stuff, and whatever your favorite is, like, God bless you. But like, I always get Luminati's, and then whenever I go downtown and I go to a show or whatever, and I'm leaving at like 1 or 2 in the morning, I get a slice from Chicago's on my way out of the city. They're open to like 4 in the morning. There's a handful of them around, and like, that's always my jam too. And like, to the point where it's almost like Pavlov's dog. I don't care if we just had dinner. Like, I might be going to get that slice right after dinner before I drive home.
I know all about. I have a couple spots in I can't get out of New York without doing the same thing.
As oh my god!
Typical bridge and tunnel guy. I got my couple spots pretty close to the tunnel where you can double park. No big deal. I don't give a shit if I'm hungry. It's just like, this happens every couple months, so you got to get it, you know?
Got to pay the pizza tax.
Exactly. That's kind of what it is. It's a toll.
Pizza tax. All right. Yeah. So what about Chicago movie?
Oh.
We going like Adventures in Babysitting?
I mean, the quintessential Chicago movie is Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Sure.
More than The Fugitive?
Yeah, more than The Fugitive. Well, and I guess... I mean, well, Breakfast Club is a great Chicago movie, but obviously it takes place indoors.
Right.
You know, almost all of it. And so you don't get a lot of Chicago. That said, you know, Ferris Bueller, a lot of it was filmed in California.
I didn't know that.
You will notice that. Like, some of those scenes have like palm trees in the background and shit. So that's, but as far as like I just... I had my girls watch it for the first time like this year, and like,
oh, okay.
And they lasted about a half hour before they got so annoyed with my laugh at parts they did not find funny. You know?
They're like, what the fuck is?
I know. Yeah. I'm just dying. I'll tell you the part I was dying too. Like when homeboy is taking attendance, you know, when he goes Bueller over and over. Yeah. But before he does
Ben Stein, right?
When Ben Stein, but it's the kid that doesn't answer the first time. Remember this?
With that weird face.
But he's like chewing gum.
Yes.
And he doesn't answer the first time, even though he heard it.
Yeah.
And then he says his name again, and he real snarkily, he looks up and goes, "Here."
Yeah.
Just like really ticked off. And I was like crying, just laughing. Just some of those scenes in that movie are just like so Chicago.
And what were your two daughters just looking at you like you're nuts?
Oh, yeah. They were like right back on TikTok and like out the door. Just like, nope, Dad, we're not doing this whole like movie from your childhood thing. It's not happening.
Yeah.
Which is crazy too, because, you know, my grandparents or my parents were from the neighborhoods that they filmed all those movies. And so my grandparents lived there when I was younger, and that's where I went for like every holiday, Christmas, Thanksgiving. It's like Evanston, Wilmette area around there.
Okay.
And that's where like Uncle Buck,
right.
Home Alone, like that house is, you know, I drive right by it when, and I would go out to my grandma's, the Home Alone house.
The Home Alone house is legit in a suburb of Chicago. That's good to know.
Yeah, that's all okay. North Shore. Like, I mean, John Hughes was from up there, and so a lot of his movies, like, you can, you know, you'll ride down Shermer Road, which John Hughes named the high school and breakfast club Shermer High.
Okay.
You know, so all that neighborhood, very much, it's like the Pretty in Pink, those neighborhoods are all there, and they feel just like those movies. They still do to this day. Like, when you ride those neighborhoods, you feel like you're riding through those movies. But I guess I got to say, Ferris Bueller, it just like, it's like, does the whole tour of like Chicago. You know, it's pretty quintessential.
I mean, you're literally at a Cubs game, you're at the museum.
Right, yeah. I mean, if it was a White Sox game, that would have been better, but like, we'll take the Cubs, you know.
Oh, okay. You're a White Sox fan.
Yeah, that's why I have security in front of my house, because I'm a White Sox fan.
Got you. I think you chose the cool team in Chicago, personally.
Yeah, I don't know why how people end up choosing teams. For me, it was like a family thing. You know, my family was always Sox fans, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but they're on fire this year, so it's exciting.
Well, the White Sox are like the New York Mets of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And totally. I've always kind of like... You know, I'm a lifelong Yankees fan, so even though I'm very proud to be such a, you know, grand winner all the time, you know, right. I do feel like maybe it's the punk rocker in me that's, you know, always like, let's give one to the Mets, you know?
Like, right, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it happens the same way in Chicago. Now,
yeah.
Speaking of your daughter, you said your daughter is 16, another one's 12.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have any effect to you and getting you into like contemporary music or movies? Like, they're old enough now that are they pulling you into some younger stuff that you wouldn't have been exposed to?
Yeah, absolutely. They never got into rock music or punk rock or any of that stuff. They're vaguely aware of what I do for a living.
Gotcha.
They see it as some sort of novelty, you know, like, oh, dad does a different kind of job than other dads, but that's about where it ends, you know?
That's cool.
And then they're way into like pop music, especially my older one. And so, you know, we've gone to the Justin Bieber concert together, you know, we've done that, you know, we've been to the Taylor Swift concerts. I've cruised her out to all the, like the pop show, the pop holiday shows, you know?
Cool.
Like whatever they call them out by you, but like, you know, whatever the big jam is, you know, it's happening.
Sure, yeah.
And so I've seen a lot of music that I would not have voluntarily seen
right.
And shows and listened to a lot. And then they control the radio too. And so I listened to a lot of music. And so it's been really, it was challenging at first. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, a single tier, my kids aren't rock kids, you know? And then it was like, and now I got to listen to this like really disposable pop music. But then I also like saw what I did see of myself in them was that they love music, you know, they don't love my music, but music is not just in the background for, especially my oldest daughter. Like it's something that she is really in tune with and loves it. And so I would take her to the shows or, you know, encourage that in any way I could, but you also got to encourage it, but you also got to like steer clear of it, you know, because if you're too involved, that's not cool at all.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You can't show your hand too much even to the point where like, if she can tell that I like something, like she'll start to distance herself from it, you know?
Oh, it's because like just inherently
it's not
whatever
cool.
Dad's like is a little less cool.
Yeah. It's not cool.
So how do you have to play it? You just play it like, yeah, this is all right.
Yes, that's totally how I play it.
Like, yeah, like right in the middle.
Right, and then our world is so small, like, as you know, that there are sometimes, like, I have some, like, even second or third degree connection with, like, the artist or their crew or their team, you know? And so sometimes I'll let that slip thinking that it's, like, a cool point. And it
will, like, I know Taylor Swift's, like, guitar tech or something.
Exactly, yeah. And actually,
yeah,
I didn't,
right.
And it's funny you bring that up because I knew Justin Bieber's guitar player and he was like a big Rise Against fan. And I met him at a show somewhere and he was a big fan. He wanted to like hang out, you know? And so I thought that was like a cool point. And my daughter only saw it as like a negative.
Like, yeah. Really?
Well, yeah, I think she was kind of like, Dad, you know, I mean, what if like, I don't know how to like, what if like your like parent was like really good buddies with like Milo from The Descendants? You know what right. I mean?
Yeah.
And be like, oh, this is so lame. How is my dad and Milo buddies, you know?
I like thought you Milo went, was cool, man.
I know. And then like, and then you're playing like Milo goes to college and your dad comes in and he's like, oh, this reminds me of a story about me and Milo, you know? And it's like, oh, you're ruining this for me, Dad, you know?
Oh, it's so funny.
And so I kind of have to like, I have to like be careful with what I, like, I'll hear a band, but I'll know that like, I know their booking agent because like she's a friend of mine. And I'll be like, I'll just keep that to myself. You know,
I feel like you're going to get the cash in this card pretty soon. I feel like you've held it pretty close and you kept it pretty cool. And then like in a couple years, she'll be off to college and maybe get like retro, get nostalgic, start going back and then realize like, oh, Dad, you played with this band. Like, I think if you keep it cool, this might, it's like a long con. You know,
I think so too. I mean, as you can imagine, she's been spoiled at these shows. You know what I mean? Like,
of course, yeah.
Justin Bieber's meet and greet crew are like half Warped Tour alumni. You know,
and you so, should like, send your daughter into some general admission situation so she knows what he's like. You know?
Yes, you are not the first person to have said that, and like, I've definitely thought it over and over.
Get out there in the shit, all right? I had to do it. You know?
I know that's the tricky balance. Where I'm like, do you know that there's not a VIP section at shows?
Yeah, some people have to wait in lines before they get in here.
Yeah, they don't always get tickets. You know,
it's funny though. I think you might be doing a good job based on a conversation I had with Ian Perkins the other day. So I was talking to Ian Perkins the other day, and I was saying how my son, who's four and three quarters, we were talking about how he wants to do a Horowitz family band record soon. And I told him to pitch me his cover art, and apparently it was going to be snowy hills with a sled on top. Mm. Well, yeah, it's nice, you know? It's artistic. Yeah. And I'm telling Ian about that, and he's like, oh, it sounds like an Elliott Smith record, man. You know? And and I'm like, well, I don't really want my child writing Elliott Smith songs, you know, because that means that I did something wrong. And that means like he's not doing that well, even though he'll write beautiful songs. And I'm like, and I was like, you know what? Like in general, if my kid gets that into punk rock or that into something like that, that might mean I'm doing something wrong. And if they're actually into like pop music and nice music and happy music and want to actually enjoy themselves and their lives, then maybe I did something right. So I'm wondering now if the real punk rock thing to do is not give punk rock to our kids.
Wow. That's pretty profound right there, Benny.
I don't know. Just say I'm just spitballing here, Tim.
It might be true.
I'm just spitballing.
Well, my wife and I just talked about whether we should like pretend to the kids that we were raging Republicans from the get-go, so that they turned out so they wouldn't, you know, they would have something to rebel against, and it's kind of the same vibe, right?
Yeah, I think
that one could backfire.
I mean, this is like the that could backfire. Yeah, that would be awful. Especially, do you guys have daughters or sons or what?
I got one of each.
Yeah, same here.
So like, you got to think about how old are all your kids?
Brad, you go.
I've got a 9-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl.
I got a 3-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy.
Okay. All right. So we both have 12-year-old girls too.
Who's very into pop music? All the names you listed.
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of Billie Eilish in your house.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
And Lizzo. She's into Lizzo, which I can totally get behind. But yes.
Oh my god. I took my kids.
Are you guys banning that Cardi B song, or are you letting it into your house?
Oh, that's the thing is like I have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old, so that's very different like filters, you know?
Right,
like
my
16-year-old hears everything. Yeah. But I mean, I brought them to, I brought my older one to the Chicago Hip Hop Station's annual show last year, which was like Migos and either either Lil Baby or Da Baby. I'm not sure which one.
It's Da Baby, yeah.
But there's also a Lil Baby Benny.
Oh, there's a Lil Baby too?
Yeah. Keep up here. Keep up with me.
You know, I get the new Post Malone record and I find out who Da Baby is and I felt really cool.
Right, yeah.
You know?
All right, totally, yeah. Well, this, yeah, I like Post Malone too. I think we were going there too. The records that she's listened to that I like I like Billie Eilish, I like Lorde, I like Post Malone.
Yeah,
I like Taylor Swift. I think that's like some really great songwriting. You know,
absolutely.
It's so
can't deny those tunes.
Like your filter changes. You know what I mean? It's like I'm not listening to this, but I will listen to this. But I'm watching Meg the Stallion with my 16-year-old daughter and her friends in like December.
Yeah,
and it was like
you're going to that show.
No, I watched it. I went to that show.
Oh, yeah. All right. No shows. Right.
Yeah, no shows. Yeah, probably not. But so I was at this show. Right. And I felt like the way like you probably felt when you were watching a movie with your parents and like the adult scene came on, like the sex scene.
Yeah.
The movie. I just remember watching Meg Thee Stallion play. And it's like, you know, she's great, does her whole thing. But I'm like, I'm watching the NC-17 version of like music right now with my 16-year-old, you know, and I think that she has a right to listen to this and hear this. I don't want to be in the same room. And I remember just turning and be like, I'm gonna go get some drinks.
Yeah,
it's like I gotta get out of this. Is like just a cringeworthy, weird moment. But that's the thing about the pop music too, is that like there's so much of it that's misogynistic, you know. Especially my older girls into a lot of like the hip hop of the day. And I can't wrap my head around why, you know, like I turned to her and I'm like, I realize that this guy is affectionately referring to his partner as his bitch. But like, just so you know, if I ever said that to your mom at any point in the last 21 years I've known her, like you wouldn't be here right now, you know, like if this was ever like a lyric in one of my songs, like your mom would not put up with this, you know? And like, and I hope that your future partner, or you don't think that your future partner should be, this is the way he should be talking about you. But anyway, I digress. What I was thinking about with all of our kids, and you were talking about like pretending that you're like a raging Republican. So your kid, if they were to rebel against you, then they would end up like in a place that you'd like them to be in. I always think about like, you know, there's six kids between us. And what that means is this next phase of life that we'll eventually all be in is there'll be six partners in your life, like six, like in-laws, like son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, whatever it's going to be. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's going to like, just like you are somebody's in-law probably, you know, that's like a whole different phase of life that like, I think about like, oh, right. I've yet to meet this person that my daughters will spend the rest of their lives with, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that's like a family. I think of my family as like over, like I'm not having more kids. You know what I mean? Like I'm married. Mm. I have two kids. This is what it looks like. It's like, no, there's still two more people coming,
right.
You know? And it's like, what's that going to be like? And what if it's somebody I can't stand, you know? Or,
yes.
or am I that person that my wife's family can't stand?
Right. Oh my God. I know. Right?
You know,
yeah.
It's huge. Like you're about to be like, you became part of someone's family and one of these 16-year-old boys running around my neighborhood right now is going to be a part of my family in like 5 years, you know?
Dude, Tim, that is fucking terrifying.
Sorry. Yeah, I didn't mean to.
Cause at first you're like, oh, you know, I'm like, oh, I could deal with the 16-year-old fool if I don't like him that much. But when you said you might be the parent, that they thought, I'm like, oh no. And I could easily be that guy. I got to tread lightly.
Oh my God.
So funny, man. Well, speaking of your kids, like, you know, you're about the same age as me. Brad is in his 70s, so we don't have to talk about that. But, you know, we were both uniquely...
I'm not going to meet those other... I'll be senile. But
yeah, long gone.
Good for you. Good for you.
Good plan, Brad.
That was the plan.
but you know, Tim and I are what I've heard recently in a magazine called Zennials.
Holy crap. Which is,
you know, basically we're in the millennial group, but we grew up in sort of more the Generation X time because we grew up without the internet, without home computers, without cell phones. And then, you know, sometime in our adolescence and teens sort of learned about all of it. Now, since you saw it firsthand, and now you have a 16 and 12-year-old who I'm sure very tied to technology and I'm sure virtual learning and stuff like mm-hmm. this at this point, you know, in your estimation, what's different about this generation as a result of that than the generation we were in? Because you sort of have like a firsthand look.
Right. That's an excellent question. There's so many things that are different. I guess the biggest thing is that technology, you know, every gap in generations, those generation gaps that exist, I'm sure everyone thinks that their gap is the biggest, right? Like,
yeah.
Right. But there was something about the introduction of the phone and the internet that I think really made our generation gap like just a really huge leap.
Yeah.
And that's, it's such a scary thing too. And I don't really even have an answer or a solution for it. And that's something that, you know, every parent has tackled with kids, my kid's age, and you'll tackle with your kids, Benny, as they're younger, is like how to navigate those murky waters that no one really has a good answer for. And the one thing that makes me like sad about like these kids' generation mm-hmm. is I think about all the cool shit I did as a kid, you know, or all the things that I did that sort of ended up, I didn't even realize we're going to be like a stepping stone into what I do today.
Yes.
And if I could go back in time and at all those moments where I did some cool shit or something, I did some really cool like endeavor out of like just sheer boredom and nothing else to do. And if I went back in time and I put an iPhone in 13-year-old Tim's hand, mm-hmm. you know, or maybe I went back further, I put an iPhone in 9-year-old Tim's hand. And then I put an iPhone in like 15-year-old Tim's hand when he first picked up a guitar, or maybe put an iPhone in the internet in 17-year-old Tim's lap, you know, mm-hmm. like I think, would I have picked up that guitar, you know,
right.
would I have, and then picking it up, it's like, it's so, being in a band is so much more than just picking up an instrument. It's, you know,
sure.
being motivated to learn it, you know, and to hopefully get good at it and then maybe create songs on it, you know, and then, you know, we all started in bands, not like solo artists. So like, it was like being friends with people in your neighborhood and right. like being a name that people thought of when they thought, I want to go play music with that guy, you know, and all the things that I did. And I just think like, if you would have put a phone in my hand, I'm not sure how many of those things would have happened.
Right.
And it's not even like when I see my girls on their phones, I see how their lives are so wrapped up into it. And when I get frustrated about it, a lot of times we'll get in fights because I think they think that like I'm criticizing them and like their choices, you know?
Yeah, right.
I know I'm bad at communicating with teenage girls. And my daughter can tell you that I am, but like, what I'm really trying to communicate is like that you are helpless to that phone. And that is not necessarily your fault or any of our faults. Like that is a perfectly designed piece of engineering that was designed to keep your attention. And right. your human brain, and certainly a teenager's half-formed human brain, and much less my human brain or anybody's human brain, is not it's not a big enough weapon to battle against that. You know, these things are dangerous in that way because I think that we are helpless to them, and so I don't expect my daughters to be able to know to put the phone down. You know what I mean? I don't think it's like part of the skill set that like they're being taught. It takes a lot of willpower to do that. And so that's what scares me. It scares me. Like, I wonder, are they missing things because of this phone? Or maybe they're not missing things. Maybe I'm overthinking it. And maybe somebody else would argue they're actually finding things. You know what I mean? They're discovering things because of this phone, you know?
Of course.
And so all of those things kind of factor in. But it makes me like not feel like a qualified person to shepherd them through this,
right?
Because I have more questions than answers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess none of us really know what it's actually doing. My only hope in what you're saying is you know, I don't know if you remember Brad Clifford, who toured with Gaslight, doing guitars
totally.
And tours with a million bands.
Absolutely.
You know, Brad once told me that I think I was knocking Instagram one day. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he wasn't like coming to bat for it, but he did say that sometimes he feels more motivated to like explore and more motivated to find something cool to take a picture of because he has the opportunity to share it. And it actually kind of sparks, you know, a little bit more adventure in a place because you're looking for something. And my hope is almost with the youth that like narcissism is going to lead to creation because mm-hmm. it's like, you know, yes, like they may be, it seems from the outside as if they're serving something that's not for themselves or they're like bowing down to this like phone overlord. But, you know, really they're trying to get attention and like mm-hmm. what teenage person is not trying to get attention? They just have a new way to try to get attention. And
right.
And I'm hoping in that way that like it's like, oh, I have the opportunity to get all this attention. Let me do something that garners that attention in a good way. And even though some people might just be like, oh, I'm going to show my breasts.
Right.
You know, some other people may be like, hey, I'm going to learn this program and write music and share this music to get that attention.
Right.
So there are like all these outlets that, you know, I don't know if they're good or bad, but they're there. And I think mm-hmm. My hope is that it fuels creation rather than stifles it.
I think that's a great point. I've thought of that too. It's like it's almost like a little cart before the horse. Like you would like to think that people want to climb to the top of the mountain out of like a natural pure desire to climb to the top of some mountain, right? Because people have done that in the past before phones and Instagram. But who am I to really judge a person who wants to climb to the top of the mountain just to get that picture?
Right.
Because if you get the picture, but it got you up the mountain.
Like exactly.
that was your motivation. And that's
you
one
still had the same experience, yeah.
Absolutely. And that's one more mountain that I didn't climb today, you know,
that's
that
right.
you climbed today. So how can I sit back and like judge like, well, there it's like a really it's kind of like for vanity and narcissism, and it's like this well posed shot, you know, at sunset on the top of some huge mountain.
That's
but
right.
it's like but I didn't do that. I sat around and judged them for doing it, you know, and said that, oh, this Instagram profile isn't real life, like, or whatever you might say to criticize it. But
that's
they
right.
did. But they did it, and so yes, yeah, parts of me see that side, and I'm new to social media. Like I only started it since the lockdown.
I was actually shocked when you followed me on Instagram. Mm. I was like, oh wow, Tim, big follow. I was like, I thought Tim Rise Against was going to have six digits here. You
no,
know,
I don't think
your,
nobody knows
your
that
numbers.
On there.
Yeah. I was really disappointed by your numbers.
Sorry,
Tim.
I need some help. If you can coach me, Benny, so one day I can be at your status.
Well, this podcast you're doing is going to give
this
you
is gonna
a good
break me through.
Yeah, you'll probably be up to 100K after this, right, Brad?
That's, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, Brad was in the Goops. I don't know, so it's a pretty big deal. You know,
I appreciate the stepping stone you guys are giving me.
Yeah, no problem, Tim.
Yeah, elevate my profile.
Anytime.
But yeah, I'm new to this whole world. I'm like turning to my daughter to like be like, how do I do this? What do I do? You know, how do you do this and not overdo it and whatever else, you know? But I do much more than I care about, like, you know, the numbers or whoever's following. It's that I realize that it's actually, I was thinking about it when I started because it was a lyric that I wrote for a new song. And the lyric was, all the things you don't say might mean something somewhere to someone.
Mm.
And I was thinking about, because there's been times in the last, I don't know, like, you know, 10 or longer years since social media has been a part of who we are, that I've felt compelled to, like, say something, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or turn
yeah.
to something. But I was also, like, my like, distaste for social media like kept me from doing that because I was like I don't even want to be a part of this, you know. And then I think as I got older, and certainly when the quarantine happened, I was thinking, like, you know, there are people out there who care about what you have to say, you know.
Right.
And I don't play in the biggest band in the world, but like as long as there's someone out there who might give a shit about my insight into this, or it might make them feel less alone in their own insight, then who am I to like just sit here and be a hermit and not share that, you know? And so that's one of the reasons, like the quarantine was one of the things that kind of accelerated that decision. But it was something that I was like, I want to connect with people that, you know, relate to my perspective and relate to our songs and might be curious. And if something I can say helps them, then like, that's, it's so lazy of me to not be a part of that just for some sort of aesthetic, like cool guy reason to just not do it, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Tim, we've taken a lot of your time, but I just got a surprise entry that I need to bring up, and it can be the last thing of the show, okay?
Of course.
It's a part of the program we called Mystery Friend.
Last-minute mystery friend.
I have a last-minute mystery friend, someone that came through for me, okay? So the point of this game is I'm going to tell you the general subject of a story that happened to you. I would like you to elaborate on this story, tell me what happened, and then choose which mystery friend told me this story, okay?
Oh, no, I'm so afraid of this moment.
So I was told, Tim, have you ever arm wrestled in a German beer hall, Sylvester Stallone over the top style?
Well, yeah, of course I have.
Of course you have. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Oh, God damn it. What was... I have a vague memory of this happening. It was a really cool German beer hall. You had to like walk down into it, and it was low ceilings. I remember turning my hat backwards before the arm wrestle began.
So wait, this was like an arm wrestling section of the beer hall where people...
This was definitely... this was not a formal arm wrestling.
But
I remember it turned into like a thing because it was the crew guys and they were all down there after the show and we joined and then the bar kind of figured out who we were and I think that it became a little bit of a thing, but nothing formal.
Who did you take on?
Did I take on Fry?
Well, Mike Fry is your mystery friend.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah. I think there's a photo of this somewhere that exists as well. Yeah.
Maybe we can make that the cover of the episode.
Totally, yeah. Oh, lots of fun adventures in Germany.
Yeah, no shit, man. Always. Mm-hmm. Well, Tim, we've been on for an hour and a half. Thanks, man.
Oh, yeah, we have. I'm sorry. I'm a talker. That's my fault.
No, that's why I asked you on. I still had questions I didn't even get to.
Oh, good. Well, you know, so. You guys are definitely to float your boat a little bit. I've listened to the Going Off Track podcast a whole bunch. For many years. And I've always thought that, I mean, you guys cover guests that I care about. So that's become a real go-to, but it's always been good conversations. You guys are having some of the best ones out there. So I was happy and honored to, because I'm a fan of the podcast.
Oh, you make me feel good.
That's very sweet.
Yeah. You guys do a great job.
Well, Tim, thanks again, man. Thanks for doing it.
Yeah. Thank you guys.
Well, that was a fun interview.
Absolutely.
Tim is cool.
Dude, he's so cool. I really enjoyed that.
So he's got socials now.
Yeah, we better get him some fans.
I got to get him to 100K or else we'll never get a guest again.
Yeah, everybody better go follow him. It's just his name, so just take the space out and find him on Instagram.
Yeah.
Rise Against Easy. Same.
Instagram, and you know how we know Tim is super famous? Is that he has a Twitter page dedicated to Tim Mikelrath quotes. I mean, that's powerful. Right. If someone's... I can't even get someone to have a fucking Wikipedia for me to just have general information about my life. And this guy's got his own Twitter with quotes, like with just famous quotes, you know? That's some like... that's like some Thoreau kind of shit if you can get to that point, you know? Like Walden. I don't know. That's pretty major. It's the next step, you know? It's the next step. And that's, again, another sly way of telling someone out there to please make a Wikipedia page for me. I mean, what do I got to do, Brad? I'm begging at this point, you know?
Come on, we must have some geek out there that's proficient.
Well, don't call him a geek.
Hey, man, I'm.
You just ruined it for me.
Oh, I'm a proud geek.
Why don't you do it then?
I tried to make a Wikipedia page once, and they never accepted it.
Wouldn't it be good for the program?
Yeah, it would be.
I got denied on Instagram. I got denied my check. I tried to get verified on Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
And in order to do it, you have to send a fucking picture of your license, which really bothered me. I was like, this fucking sucks. That means Facebook has my license right now. And a couple people were like, yeah, you should really do it. My wife said I should do it. So I'm like, fine, I guess I'll do it.
Close.
And then I submitted my license and got denied. So now they have my information and I didn't get the blue check. Double negative.
But you're close. You're really close to like the automatic.
What do you do though?
10K.
I got denied.
You gotta get 10K and then you're good to go though.
I don't know, man. I don't think I could do it.
You're almost there, I thought. Oh well, whatever. I'm not gonna
listen. Listen. I've had a hard time pandering to these social media sites to begin with. Being rejected by them is not something
it's
I was
worst.
Emotionally ready for, you know? I really wasn't.
It's like when your friends take you kicking and screaming to some club you don't want to go to, and then the bouncer doesn't let you in anyway.
And then it sucks anyway. Yeah.
Dude, I didn't want to come in.
I didn't even want to be here, man. You know what? Fuck you. I didn't even want to come in. I know it just sounds like that because everyone says that when they can't get in, but I really didn't want to be here.
But now I do want to get in.
Yeah,
asshole.
But now can you hook me up, dude? I'll take my hat off, I swear. Yeah. What is, you ever been in a bar that did that where at like 6 o'clock they're like, take your hat off?
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm like, take your fucking hat off, meathead.
I've been around too many backwards baseball caps in my life to like to really make a fuss about that particular rule.
Mm.
Sorry, Benny.
You know, my grandpa always used to say, I used to wear a backwards baseball cap. He'd be like, what are you, a catcher? What are you, a catcher? And then my other grandpa, when I started sagging my pants and wearing the big pants, he said, it looks like you got a load in your pants. See, this is wisdom. Wisdom from another time.
I love it. I love it.
I mean, those pants were really big. It was the 90s.
Yeah, I remember that decade. Vaguely.
JNCOs. See, your pants were small in that decade.
JNCOs,
mine were big.
I was wearing tight pants, dude.
Yeah. No, I was full on skater. I would buy like the biggest jeans I could possibly get and then cut them to make like the biggest shorts.
Right.
But I was also a chubby kid. So I know we've talked about this where just hardcore fashion at the time was really conducive to a chubby kid.
Yeah.
You know, the baggy pants, hoodies. Yeah, I had nothing to worry about. Easy peasy. You know, shave your head, throw on a hoodie, throw on some big stuff. Easy, you know? Wow. Now there's all these standards. You got to have like a full sleeve and a plug and some cool shirts.
Got to be kitted out, dude.
Your jeans have to be ripped before you even buy them, you know?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
What is that? What is that? But we have a Patreon now. Speaking of ripped jeans.
Oh, and we just got a new patron.
Ooh. We did.
I mean, we got a couple since we've talked about it. We got a big one.
Yeah, I got it. I'm going on now that I can log on.
Oh, but if you are interested.
Vicente. Am I saying that right?
I don't know. Probably.
Vicente.
Thank
gave
you.
Gave us one. Thanks, man.
Patreon.com/goingofftrack. And, there'll be more and more bonus content probably as now that I'm back from the woods.
Yeah.
Social media manager. We've got some stuff up there that's pretty interesting, I think. There's one full episode. No, there's two full episodes, full podcast episodes that you can only get there.
Yeah.
So, check that
and
out.
I've been writing some random shit.
Benny makes his guest appearances every so often.
Well, but, I felt compelled this last one to talk about Tune In, Drop Out because of how badly I messed up talking about Timothy Leary in the last episode with Barty Strange. I was like, man, I sounded dumb. So
I didn't notice that. You didn't sound stupid, Benny.
I was like, drop in.
Oh, right.
Tune in. You know, the thing that he
I
said.
I thought it was funny that you didn't know it. I mean, come on. That's like, you know, that's some grandpa shit there.
I know, but it would imply that I'm doing acid and that's why I like him so much.
Oh.
Like, I think if someone listened to only last week's episode and saw the Patreon, they think I'm like a heavy drug guy, like like into like mushrooms and ayahuasca journeys and things like that, you know? I don't plan on doing that till I'm 70. I'm going Alan Arkin and Little Miss Sunshine. That's my plan.
It's a good
Once
plan.
I hit 70, I'm going to have a little bag of heroin I'm going to bring around with me.
Hey, that's my plan, dude.
Yeah?
Yeah, hell yeah. It's been my plan for ages.
Well, I wish you weren't going to hit 70 about 35 years before me. That's fuck.
I'm there, man. I'm on the program.
We could have done it together.
Yeah, I probably won't last. I won't be able to wait for you.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of more funny Tim stories, but I don't have them.
This is a long one. We should probably wrap this up.
We should wrap.
You can go reminisce about him on Patreon.
Okay, I'll write something on Patreon. Yeah. I'll think of something funny.
You could even record something if you want and just blab it out there.
That's true. Good idea, Brad.
The idea guy.
Look at that egg on your head. Good work. All right. I got to take these kids to a doctor's appointment.
Well, good luck with that.
Thanks, pal.
Thank you, all you fans out there. And go, you know, follow Tim on Instagram.
Yeah. And listen to Rise Against.
Oh, please, if you haven't. Hello.
Everybody needs a little Rise Against in their lives
and
right now.
Peg I Boy. Actually. Don't forget Peg
yes,
Boy.
Yes. And please listen to Peg Boy, actually. If you heard this interview and you have not heard Peg Boy, that is a all-time legendary band that you really shouldn't miss. That's a fact. And what's cool is, you know, there's a couple videos in Rise Against catalog and some of the stuff that they talked about that's really, really relevant now, you know?
Oh.
Especially particularly in the last few months.
Yeah.
So they were onto something. Tim's a smart guy.
He is very smart. But you know that because you just heard him talk.
Oh, yeah. You just heard him for a long time. All right. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us. And we'll see you next week.
Ciao.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.